It's a small beginning, but it's a great beginning. A coalition government with a president pro tem that's Democratic and a majority leader that's Republican. And those reforms they passed yesterday, I think, are absolutely remarkable.
Tom Golisano, the independent candidate for governor a few times, Rochester businessman, now the power broker in the coup in Albany, talking about reform as the redeeming feature of all this earlier in the week. And when Governor Spitzer was elected, it was supposed to be about reform. And remember the joke by Governor Patterson when he was sworn in after Spitzer's downfall, asked if he ever patronized a prostitute? Patterson's reply was, only the lobbyists. Patterson was supposed to be a reformer. But what do we mean by reform? Well, a new book by Mayor Bloomberg's chief speechwriter says attempts at reform have themselves become scandals in New York City and New York State. He says real reform would be the mayor's idea for nonpartisan elections. That idea was defeated in a referendum in the city in 2003. The book is called The Scandal, or defeated in its attempt to go to a referendum. The book is called The Scandal of Reform, The Grand Failures of New York's Political Crusaders, and the Death of Nonpartisanship. The author, Francis Barry, is an advisor and director of speech writing for Mayor Bloomberg. We will talk about the current news with reform as the centerpiece, or at least the Trojan horse, and we will talk about the larger issues. Francis, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And we'll talk about the mess in Albany through the lens of your book, plus the mayoral election upcoming and more. But you are down on reform, as we usually think of it. Can you define it first?
Well, that is a tough question. I'm not so much down on reform as I think it needs another look. Reform has always been held up as a special movement in American history. It holds a special place. Reformers are seen as these great champions of democracy, as those who want to restore virtue to city government. And when you actually look at the historical record, it's a very different story. Looking back through the 19th century in New York, you see that reformers were trying to pass laws that were phenomenally anti-democratic, whether it was trying to disenfranchise the propertyless or disenfranchise the illiterate or immigrants. Reformers were consistently had a very anti-democratic bent.
Anti-democratic bent, because when I think of reform, I think of steps to make government more democratic, small d, as what it's all about, more responsive to more citizens and less in the control of a small, unrepresentative power elite. That definition doesn't work for you?
Well, it didn't hold for that was not the original definition of reform, and it didn't hold for an awfully long time. Now, everyone remembers Boss Tweed as the great, corrupt tyrant of Tammany Hall. Certainly there was plenty of corruption in Tammany. However, it was just in the years after Boss Tweed's downfall in the 1870s that reformers were one step away from passing a constitutional amendment to the state of New York's constitution that would have disenfranchised about half of all New York City voters.
And what was that?
What was the law?
Yeah.
Well, the law required you to hold a certain amount of property. I think it was $500 worth of property in order to be a voter. And then in order to hold office on what they would have set up, these boards of finance, you would have also needed to have been a property holder. So there was this sense
of... So nobody would call them reformers today. They called them the oligarchy.
That's right. That's right. They were really trying to set up an urban aristocracy. But that's what reform was in the 19th century. Now, reform, of course, has changed over time. And so when you say, how do you define reform? It is difficult to do so. But whereas reformers in the 19th century were trying to pass laws that were very anti-democratic, reformers were successful in the 20th century in passing laws. The Progressive Era is remembered as a tremendous golden age of reform. And yet, when we look at some of the effects of the Progressive Era laws today, what we see is that there has been a real anti-competitive consequence to many of the laws that were passed. And so One of the purposes of the book really is to, we've done some reevaluation of the 19th century reformers and where they were wrong, but in looking at the reforms of the Progressive Era, we've continued to hold, say, the direct primary and these other laws as kind of sacred writ, when in fact they've really had some negative consequences that we still need to grapple with.
You're against primaries? Party primaries?
Absolutely no. I'm not against party primaries. Now, you know, one of the things that I found most interesting in researching in the book was that there was a phenomenal amount of competition within the Democratic primary in the 19th century. You had all of these different factions competing with one another, trying to control the party, trying to win election. Now, those took place not only in party primaries that were unregulated and that the parties held, but also in the general election. So you had different Democrats competing in the general election against each other. Now, today, with the passage of progressive era election laws, we no longer have that. And all of the competition takes place within the Democratic primary, which we know is a very low turnout affair and is not open to any other voters. But the point is that when you had...
When you say not any other voters, like it's a private club, 80% of New Yorkers are registered as Democrats, if we're talking about New York City, right?
It's true. The number is a little bit lower. It's about 66%.
Okay.
And the number of independents is growing. But the idea was in the 19th century, there was a tremendous amount of competition that voters were exposed to within the Democratic Party. And they would have real options come general election day. Now the only options really, with the exception of the office of mayor, the only options that voters are really given are on primary day. And that is a result of the progressive era regulations that have effectively shut out other Democrats from participating in the general election.
And we can take phone calls for Francis Barry, author of The Scandal of Reform, at 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692, or comment on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. I want to stay on that point because I think that's your central point, and it's really, really important to our listeners who are concerned about good government, who are concerned about as much democracy as possible in New York City as everywhere. One of your main critiques is that the good government reform community, ostensibly nonpartisan, has gradually become indistinguishable from the left wing of the Democratic Party. Do you see that in the good government policy agenda?
I think we do see it. I think that one of the things that did distinguish reformers, the early reformers, as much as they were very wrong on a lot of the issues, one of the things they got right was the nonpartisanship. And that meant bringing together people of both Republicans and Democrats and others in creating a legitimate kind of consensus movement, coalition, fusion. That's what fusion was. Fusion was a coalition idea where people compromised for a common platform that they could rally behind. Today, fusion is something very different. Third parties claim the mantle of fusion, but it's really a cross endorsement system where they are hopping around from race to race and endorsing those candidates who agree with them in an ideological way. And you ask about the ideologicalization of the good government groups, and I think that beginning in the 60s, as the parties began to decline in strength, that movement for coalitional fusion also declined. And in its place, we were left with advocacy groups, which brought a lot of dynamism and vibrancy to democracy and added a lot. But they continued to claim this mantle of nonpartisanship, which was not really reflected in the positions they took and even in the people and the groups that were part of them.
But you suggest in the book that good government reform would mean steps to empower the Republican Party in New York City. Did you mean to say that?
Well, no. I think good government reform would be a broader diversity of voices within good government groups and within government. You know, Al Smith, the great Democratic governor of New York, talked about how it was necessary to have a check on a great power. And that was, whether it's the Republican Party or another party that plays that role or whether it's a fusion group, I think it's important for there to be other voices that participating in government.
I guess the question is, what is the relevant political diversity in New York City? Because the Republican Party, or what it's become in this country, just doesn't represent the values or interests of New Yorkers very much these days. So why would it be good government to prop it up?
Well, I don't think the Republican Party has ever reflected the National Republican Party. And the Republicans in New York have always been a party of fusion and a party of reform, to the extent that they've been successful, that is. So all of the Republican mayors we've ever had have never run on a Republican platform, a national platform, that is. They have always built coalitions with Democrats, and often Republicans have endorsed Democrats. The election of John Perry Mitchell in 1913 is a great example of that, where the Republican Party swung behind a Democrat And the party has always been, when successful, a group that is safe enough for Democrats to join.
And so maybe political diversity in this city needs to be defined by something other than Democrat and Republican, because modern Republicanism of the national kind is so irrelevant here. The factions and fusion you write about are ethnic and religious and by neighborhood and class and immigrant status, not Democratic and Republican.
Well, I think there's a lot to that. I think that there, in governing a city, there's really not a whole lot of national party ideological politics that come into play. And that's one of the arguments for nonpartisan elections, is that you want someone who is more manager than politician.
And there's not much of a functioning Democratic machine in the city anymore, is there? I mean, the Democrats haven't elected a mayor in 20 years. City Council is 90% Democrat, but it's politically very weak. So there's no powerful machine, is there?
No, the machines have really declined. You're right. However, they are still hanging on, and the machines still certainly hold power over the lower offices. The machines are no longer picking governors and senators.
They're picking the judges, unfortunately.
But they are still picking the judges, and they're still having a big hand in who wins city council as well. The endorsement of a county leader is still a very prized commodity among those running for council.
All right. Let's take a phone call. This is Jim in the West Village. Jim, you're on WNYC.
Thank you for taking my call. I am a lifelong Democrat. I live in District 3, which is Christine Quinn's district, and I am running for city council, and I would like to have run as a Democrat. But after going through the process of endorsement for the Democratic clubs, it became very clear to me that it is impossible to beat this particular incumbent because of her relationship to Mayor Bloomberg and the power of her slush fund of buying people's support. There's not a single Democratic Party political person that has not endorsed her other than Deborah Glick. This is a woman who's under criminal investigation for fraud. So I am going to now run as an independent in this district, something I never thought I would do as a lifelong Democrat, having always worked and voted as a Democrat, but it's the only way to bring a Democratic choice to the voters in my district.
Why wouldn't the Democratic primary, if the things you say about Christine Quinn are true and voters should see her in that light, why wouldn't the Democratic primary be the vehicle for you?
First of all, she is under criminal investigation. That is a matter of truth. That is not a matter of conjecture. So that, I just want to make that clear, Brian. I'm not making an accusation. That's not based in fact. The process, watching her go through the Democratic clubs who have not supported her previously, there are three candidates running in this district in the Democratic primary. Watching her pull the support of every elected official and party person meant that that machine is very, very powerful and in place. And as your guest just said, on the city council races, the machine is very active. It's just as impossible for us to unseat this woman when she's getting endorsed by unions, by politicians, by Democratic clubs.
Jim, thank you very much. The investigation that he talks about is into the large issue of the so-called slush fund that city council has had. I know Larry Seabrook, councilman, was in a big article in the Times this week around that. Christine Quinn, as council leader, has come under investigation. Do you know, just to clarify that one point, is it accurate to say she is under criminal investigation?
I don't know that. I would not have said that she was. I'm not familiar enough with the case.
But there is an investigation into that whole ball of wax, and she's got a role there. So I don't want to underplay it or overplay it. But is he an example of the kind of lack of good government reform or faux good government reform that you're essentially concerned with?
I think he's a good example, not too familiar with the case, but I think he's a good example of how difficult it is to get on the ballot and to challenge an incumbent in a Democratic primary. And one of the benefits, I think, of moving to a nonpartisan system is that you would be able to draw on independent voters and others, meaning target them, go after them, ask for their vote. Whereas now you're dealing only with what they call prime voters, those who always come out in the Democratic primary are kind of least likely to buck an incumbent. And so that's one of the reasons I think so many incumbents lined up against nonpartisan elections was it would have made life a little bit more difficult for them and more difficult to win re-election. And it not only would have given more candidates, it would have made it easier for them to get on the ballot. it also would have forced them into a real general election when they had a race, not just a primary campaign.
Right. Now, you work for Mayor Bloomberg, so that should be on the table. But it had the whiff of self-interest coming at that time from that mayor, didn't it? Because here's a guy who famously jumps parties repeatedly for his political convenience. If he weakens the existing parties, it strengthens him. So maybe he was completely earnest in this proposal and his belief in it, but the timing was suspicious. And well, I think people reacted to that.
They did, and that was one of the reasons why the mayor asked for it not to take effect in the 2005 campaign, which is something the Charter Commission did. And
that was a late revision to it.
Right. It came in July of that year. That can play both ways. You know, the idea that it would have somehow made it easier for the mayor is cuts both ways, because, you know, had he been in a nonpartisan race, he would have had a real race in September. He would have had to make the first two in order to make it to November.
But another argument at that time was that when you talk about factions and fusion, that the parties really represent people on the ground. And the idea, which is kind of a good government reformer idea of, you know, the independent-minded citizen sitting back in a lounge chair and weighing the issues and which is good and which is bad in some, detached, judicious way, is not real life. And on the ground, when people have interests and needs, it is the parties. It is, you know, in New York, it's mostly the local Democratic clubs who are going out and being in touch with the people on the ground and then organizing around their political interests.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the misunderstandings that we had a hard time correcting was that the proposal would not have diminished the ability of the parties to do all of those things. I think that's an important role for parties, mobilizing voters, educating voters, getting to the polls. That does not change under a nonpartisan system. It's only a question of whether or not we are allowing the parties to effectively end the race come September, come their government-regulated party primary, or whether or not we're going to continue the race between the top two finishers in a November runoff.
Let me get one more caller in here. Joanna in Southport. You're on WNYC with Frank Barry, author of The Scandal of Reform. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment. Over the past 20 years, I've noticed that it's billionaires and millionaires who choose the candidates, and they're on both sides, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. They've kind of caged their options there. And that I think that, and the unfortunate thing I've noticed is amongst these people, they don't even vote. But these candidates are brought to the primary, and we're given either one or two. So there really isn't choice. And I'm interested to see whether a third party will emerge, a more independent party system will emerge because of this, because I think people are coming, more and more becoming aware of this situation, that we really need absolute reform. And I'm also wondering whether the system has just worn itself out.
Briefly on this, on the two-party system needing to become more of a multi-party system to be more responsive to the people.
Well, I think that would be one of the intended benefits of nonpartisan elections, is opening up the process to independents, to multi-party candidates, in a way that right now they really do not have an effective means to participate in the dialogue. And whether it's the party bosses or, as you say, the millionaires, et cetera, who are kind of hand selecting the candidates, right now it's much easier for them to pick the winners through in the current rule setup, where all they've got to do is win a low turnout primary, than it would be if they had to win a high turnout general.
So before we run out of time, let's go back to the mess in Albany. Here is Republican State Senator Carl Marcellino on this program an hour ago talking about good government reforms that he says the new coalition has enacted.
We passed on Monday rules changes that the Democrats promised to deliver and never did. We passed them on Monday. That significantly changes the way business will be done in the future in New York State. How bills will come to the floor, how resources will be shared, how staffing will be done, how bills will get out of committee, how bills will be debated and discussed. We set really good bills out there, really good rules out there. NYPERG has endorsed those rules before we passed them. They asked the Democrats to pass them. The Democrats said they would, but never did. We did it.
real reform in Albany, by your definition?
Well, I think we're still in a wait and see. But if out of all this mess we end up with some real reforms, which it does seem like they are committed to doing, and I think the pressure will be on them because they are claiming the mantle of reform. But Albany has been, so dysfunctional for so long that if out of this crazy week we do end up with real reforms, it may well have been worth it. We'll see.
Francis S. Barry has written The Scandal of Reform, The Grand Failures of New York's Political Crusaders, and The Death of Nonpartisanship. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.